Hello and welcome. Today on Providing Pediatrics, we're addressing the unique challenges of pediatric care. My name is Charles Woolley and I'm your host. Today's conversation is with Dr. Brian Ebel. We will be discussing pediatric cardiac emergencies. Thank you, Dr. Ebel, for being here. I really am excited to have this conversation with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful. So looking over your bio, there's so much to get into. What's the one thing that you're the most proud of? That I know that you have this, you're really interested in exercise cardiology. Is that your one thing, or what is your one thing that you would say is your proudest thing that you bring to the table?
The proudest thing that I bring to the table is getting to see kids be well and go home from the hospital.
I did not see that on your bio.
But by far and away, I get to work as part of a team.
Right.
And there's nothing that I do by myself. I am proud of the work that our team does in taking kids that maybe they actually have a normal heart, but somebody heard something, or the patient or the family saw something that made them worry. And we get to reassure them that their heart is normal and perfect. And sometimes we see babies that are critically ill, that are so ill that they actually have to go on a heart-lung bypass machine to save their lives. But by far and away, my proudest moments are the kids that we get to take care of, whose families have trusted us with taking care of their hearts, who then, ideally with our help, get better and get to go home and get to live their best life and get to be loved on by their families.
Absolutely. I knew that about you just from our conversations. Absolutely. And the little bit of time that I've shadowed you, I know you care a lot. And it's evident in your bedside manner and the way you interact with your patients and families. Your bio is so impressive. Your CV is so impressive. But the one thing that you say I bring to the table is I care. You laid that out there really quickly. But you cannot care without feelings, right? How do you deal with those bad ones, the ones that you lose? Because I've seen you care. So how do we cope?
So for me personally, my faith in God plays a critical role. In sometimes we don't win our battle.
Mm-hmm.
But in my worldview, I believe that this is not our home, that this is where we are temporarily while God is still working on us. It also helps to surround ourselves with people that love us and trust us.
Yeah.
And that we can love and trust in return. And so if I get to come to work every single day and work with 24 other cardiologists that I would trust with my own daughter,
nice.
Then I know that the quality of care that we're providing is elite, very, very high. And if in spite of that, we don't win all of our battles, then we can lean on each other to help cope and move on to the next patient that we're taking care of, even if things don't go the way we had hoped with one of our patients.
That's beautiful. So, you know, we really encourage the people that listen to this podcast, because they're people who probably don't take care of pediatric patients on a regular basis. And sometimes those outcomes are not great. Like you said, lean on each other, you know, lean on it, talk to each other. I think all the things you said was absolutely wonderful. Usually I bring this up at the very end of the podcast, but we just put it out there on the table about care, and it just seemed right to talk about how do we deal. So thank you for sharing that.
It takes a village.
Absolutely. So I know I've asked you this before, but let's talk about your journey to Arkansas Children's. Where did you grow up?
So my parents put each other through school at different times. So I grew up in West Virginia, Nebraska, Missouri, and Oklahoma. I ended up landing in Missouri, Joplin, Missouri, for high school. And then I went to University of Missouri, Columbia for college and med school. My advisor told me that he would write me a very strong letter of recommendation for residency when I was ready to apply for pediatrics on the condition that I interviewed here. And I told him, there's no way I'm spending 3 years of my life in Little Rock, Arkansas. And he said, well, that's fine. I don't want to force you to go somewhere you don't want to go. But if you don't apply there, I'm not going to write your letter. I was like, well, but I really need your letter of recommendation. So at his insistence, I came down here and interviewed for residency. And this Arkansas Children's blew my socks off. This is, God made it very clear that this is where I belong and where I'm supposed to be. And so this is where I matched for my residency. I met a girl.
Yeah.
We got married. I dragged her. We were not training cardiologists at the time I finished my residency in 2002. So I dragged my new wife away from all of her family and all of her friends down to Houston so I could complete my training in cardiology. And then this was the only place either of us ever interviewed for a job. We knew we were coming back.
Wow. What was it? What was the draw? Other than just a spiritual feeling in your heart, what was the draw?
That spiritual feeling was 75-80%
okay,
of it.
Gotcha.
The other 20% was, there's no other group that I know of where I would trust every single one of my partners to take care of my daughter.
Nice.
And huge. I can say that.
That's huge.
Here at Arkansas Children's, I would trust every single one of my partners to take care of Sophie.
Wow. That's good stuff. Thanks for sharing that too. I love it. Let's talk about what happened to Damar Hamlin. Let's start there.
Yeah.
So walk us through what happened with Damar Hamlin, and then we'll kind of lead in, that'll kind of lead us into talking about sudden cardiac arrest in youth sports.
Yeah. So Damar Hamlin, playing defense for the Buffalo Bills, went in for a tackle and took a shoulder to his chest.
Okay.
Knocked to the ground, got up, and then went unresponsive. He got very high quality CPR. His being unresponsive and pulseless was remarkably quickly recognized by the medical caregivers right there on the field. He got very high quality CPR completely appropriately, and he got defibrillated on the field. And they actually got return of spontaneous circulation, or ROSC, there on the field after about 10 minutes.
Wow.
So then he got transported to the hospital and required critical care for several days as his heart, his brain, his lungs, his other organs that had been, you know, without effective blood flow and oxygen delivery for 10 minutes.
Sure.
As those organs continued to heal well enough that he could breathe on his own and get discharged out of the hospital and start his rehabilitation. I mean, but what an amazing success story is that Damar Hamlin got to rehabilitate.
Right. Amazing.
Yep.
So the point of impact.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the pathophysiology of what actually, how that happens.
Yep.
I know it's super rare, but there's actually a case that happened here in Arkansas that I've heard stories about.
Yeah. So the Latin name for this is commotio cordis.
Sure.
That's a big fancy word that means commotion or agitation of the heart.
Okay.
It turns out that if you get a blunt trauma to the front wall of your chest over top of your heart, and it has to be perfectly timed.
Okay.
After the heart squeezes or contracts, the heart then relaxes. Electrically, what's going on as the heart relaxes is it's repolarizing. That means the electricity has changed direction, and it's getting the heart muscle ready for the next contraction.
Okay.
So during a very, very narrow window, as the heart is relaxing and filling up with blood and the electricity is getting ready for the next heartbeat, if you get a blunt trauma blow over the chest wall over top of the heart during that very fragile period, then it can put your heart into a life-threatening fast arrhythmia called ventricular tachycardia.
Okay.
Or ventricular fibrillation. And during that arrhythmia, the heart is then squeezing so fast that it doesn't have time to fill up in between heartbeats.
Right.
So it doesn't do an efficient job of pumping blood and oxygen either through the coronary arteries back to the heart muscle itself or to the rest of your body like your brain. So while you're in very fast VT, ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation, then the heart is not pumping blood in an effective way or oxygen to the body. And so you go to ground, you become unresponsive. If you don't get high quality CPR and eventually defibrillated, then the chances of your dying are very, very, very high.
Absolutely. Wow, it's crazy to think about an athlete on the field. The heart rate has to be up, right? I mean, sure, he's in great shape, but his heart rate has to be up. So now we're talking, what are the chances? What are the odds, right, of hitting that moment right before repolarization?
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy that that happened right then. That's why it's so rare, obviously.
Fortunately.
Yeah, fortunately.
It's very rare.
Wow.
Yep.
You know, we do Project Adam. You're my medical director for Project Adam. We really believe in this stuff. And we had just kind of got, I had just kind of gotten my wheels rolling on Project Adam when all this happened.
Yep.
And I watched this play out on the field. It's the exact same thing that we ask folks to do in their schools, right? We go and we say, hey, build a team, build an emergency response plan, come up with a, you know, this, who's going to do what, when they're going to do it. And that's exactly what they did in the NFL. And I recently heard somebody speak about this from the NFL, and they talked about, yeah, this is what we do. We have a written response plan. They call it an EAP, yep, or an emergency action plan, yep, in the sports world. We call it a SERP, cardiac emergency response plan. In the school world, same thing. We, yep, just write a written plan out that says, hey, you're going to do chest compressions. I'm going to run the airway, and we're going to ask Jason over there to go get the AED, right? So we practice that, and the NFL practices it. I saw a thing not too long ago where they have like a third party person that comes in and tests this exact same thing. They do it every summer. And that's what we do in the school. So it was really neat to see all that kind of come together. So the keys to success for that cardiac arrest in sports medicine, even if it's on the basketball court, the keys to success is a take it from there.
High quality CPR.
Sure.
We've gotten away from it. Used to be called bystander CPR.
Sure.
Terrible name, because you're not a bystander. If you're the one that's providing life-saving CPR, you're not a bystander. You're a layperson.
Sure.
You're most people that are going to do layperson CPR are not medically trained. But if they've been trained how to do high quality CPR, that, depending on which resource you use, that doubles or even quadruples your chance of surviving a cardiac arrest. Is good, high quality CPR, and then early defibrillation. Send somebody to get an AED, and ideally have an AED around close so that it's not 20 minutes longer than that away.
Right.
Because the faster you can get the heart defibrillated back into a spontaneous circulation, a perfusing, more efficient rhythm, the higher your chances are of a good quality outcome.
Give me two underlying causes that set athletes, I shouldn't say set them up for this, but
yeah.
What are we looking at whenever we see sudden cardiac collapse or sudden cardiac arrest on the basketball court, soccer field, wherever it might be?
Yep. So fortunately, as you've already pointed out, Charles, commotio cordis is quite rare.
Right.
The terrifying thing about commotio cordis is it is preventable with some protective gear, but there's nothing that we can do to identify people that are at risk, because they have a structurally completely normal heart. They don't have a family history that we can ask about. We can ask questions about of the athlete or the family. They have a completely normal cardiac exam when you listen to their heart with a stethoscope. So they're going to check all of the normal healthy boxes on a pre-participation physical sports, sure, exam. But as you've said, it's fortunately quite rare. And because it is largely unpreventable, it behooves us to have an emergency action plan in place. The underlying heart diseases, sometimes we can detect that puts an athlete or a student at an increased risk of dying suddenly, especially playing sports.
Okay.
In this country, by far, the most common underlying heart problem is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is a genetic disease. It tends to run in families, although it is possible for you to be the first one in your family with it. That causes a mutation in a gene that forms the sarcomere. The sarcomere is the microscopic group of proteins that makes the inside each heart muscle cell that makes the heart muscle squeeze or contract.
Okay.
If you have a genetic defect with the way one of those proteins are made, then you may develop hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. What that looks like if you cut somebody's heart out and look at it is the heart muscle is going to be thicker than a normal heart muscle. That increases your risk of having inadequate blood flow or oxygen delivery to your heart muscle, especially with exercise, which increases the risk of having a dangerous or life-threatening heart rhythm problem like ventricular tachycardia or ventricular fibrillation when you're exercising at a very high level. It's actually fascinating to me is that heart muscle that is thicker than normal is harder for your coronary branches, the blood vessels that are taking oxygen-rich red blood back into the heart muscle to keep it alive. If you have obstruction in one of those branches, you have a heart attack or a myocardial infarction.
Sure.
But if your heart muscle is very, very thick, then that actually keeps or prevents the coronary branches from providing all of the oxygen delivery back into the heart muscle, especially when the heart is beating hard when you're exercising.
Gotcha. And the whole time, it's easy to think, okay, it's thickening. There's not going to be, it's going to have a decreased ejection, and that's going to be the problem, right? But really, it's about the heart muscle.
Yes, and it's multifactorial.
Sure.
And why one kid with hypertrophy, and this is largely unpredictable as well, because some kids with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy will never have anything bad happen to them.
Sure.
And one of the other reasons I bring that up is because one of the things as cardiologists we're asked to do is see a kid that may be having shortness of breath or chest pain when they exercise. And to me, it's sort of miraculous why any of us feel that. Like, we all feel we have chest pain when we exercise hard, and we all feel like we have shortness of breath. So why is it that in 98% of us, the amount of pain or shortness of breath that we feel like we have when we're exercising is appropriate and doesn't warrant any further evaluation? Like, that's amazing to me. Like, I've never exercised in your body, but I think I know the amount of shortness of breath and discomfort that I feel when I go out and try to run is a normal amount of discomfort and shortness of breath. But one of the things we get asked to sort out is athletes may also have a thicker than normal heart muscle simply because they've trained.
Right.
And so distinguishing between an athlete's heart, which is a normal heart that's been trained hard to participate at high level sports, from hypertrophic cardiomyopathy may actually not be as straightforward as it sounds. And so sometimes we get asked to see, this is a kid that plays at a very high level and is banking on getting a D1 scholarship to play college level sports, but their heart muscle is a little bit thicker than normal. Is it okay for them to continue to play?
Yeah, that's a conundrum for sure.
It
and
is.
I've heard that exact same story from survivors. Like, yeah, sure, I had shortness of breath, and sure, I had some chest pain, but so did everybody else, right? And how do I know if mine's, you know, that's just, and so that always brings up the screening question. But I'm going to let you go ahead and tell me about the second most common thing we see. Is it WPW or is that?
Yeah, so it's actually a different kind of channel problem.
Okay.
Wolff-Parkinson-White, or WPW, is an accessory pathway. It's a short circuit It's an extra pathway that lets electricity bypass the normal conducting fiber that lets electricity and most of us get from the top of the heart to the bottom of the heart. Right. It turns out that even if you have Wolff-Parkinson-White, your chances of dying suddenly are still very, very low, even if you participate in sports.
Yeah.
And we're actually pretty good at diagnosing Wolff-Parkinson-White with a fairly cheap test called an EKG. If you have Wolff-Parkinson-White or WPW, we're really pretty good at picking that up on a screening baseline ECG.
Sure.
A more common, at least in this country, cause of dying suddenly with sports is long QT syndrome.
Long QT, sure.
Long QT is a channelopathy. It's a problem with the sodium or potassium channels that let salt in and out of heart muscle cells that also can cause a short circuit of electricity and put you at an increased risk of going into a twisting about a point, which is torsade de pointe, which is a specific type of ventricular fibrillation.
Right. I just have to ask, why is it always 16, 17-year-old on the basketball court or the volleyball court? What? Why?
Yeah. So it turns out that kids before adolescence are way smarter than their doctors. And if they are trying to play sports at a very aggressive high level and they don't feel bad, then they quit.
Okay.
They quit playing. They stop and they catch their breath and they go get something to drink.
Sure.
But 16 to 18-year-olds have a different incentive. They are now trying to impress somebody, their parents or their coaches or their significant other.
Sure.
Or they're actually pushing themselves harder to play at a higher level for other reasons just than because they enjoy playing sports.
Gotcha.
And there's something about the propensity to go into a heart rhythm because of an underlying heart problem, like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or long QT syndrome or a congenital abnormality of the way your coronary arteries supply blood and oxygen to your heart muscle. It's a combination of that underlying propensity along with playing at a very, very high level of sports.
What about screening? Is there a way that we can... And you knew I was going to ask you this. Right?
Absolutely.
I know that there's a lot of folks that would like to believe, and we would like to believe, you and I would like to believe, that we could fix it with screening. And is there an answer to that?
Yes. And the answer is no.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is there's no perfect screening test.
Okay.
We will always need an emergency action plan and people that know how to provide high quality CPR and know how to put the sticky pads from an automated external defibrillator onto somebody's heart and shock them back into a healthy heart rhythm. But that doesn't mean that we should quit trying to screen.
Right.
And so the best way to screen is the Heart Association, ACC, AAP guidelines, which are take a history and do an exam of everybody that wants to play sports. And the history needs, and it needs to include all 10 points. The history needs to include, has anybody in your family died suddenly, especially under the age of 50? Does anybody in your family have a cardiomyopathy like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? If you have a first degree relative that's died suddenly or has a heart disease that we know can run in families like long QT syndrome, then you need to be checked for that by a heart doctor that thinks about heart disease all the time. Have you ever passed out while you were playing sports? If you have, then you need to be checked out.
Sure.
If you have an abnormal exam, like you have a heart murmur that is not a normal, benign, innocent heart murmur. So those history red flags and physical exam red flags. Do you have high blood pressure? Does a doctor who's good at feeling pulses have a hard time feeling the pulses in your legs? So any of those red flags, those warrant further evaluation because that is a positive screen. That doesn't mean you can't play sports. It means that somebody that knows how to screen somebody and rule out dangerous underlying heart disease has evaluated you and feels confident clearing you to play.
That's a lot. And we would like to eliminate all of those with screening. Sure. Just starting out with talking about it, it was like, okay, you could totally miss this and this is how. So there's just so many variables there. Kind of getting back to the treatment for these kids, and I just want to be clear, we're talking about sudden cardiac arrest, and this is something that in the last little bit I've really had to kind of face, because here's the thing, I grew up in the emergency department and on an ambulance, right? And so I preached cardiac arrest in the pediatric population is driven by respiratory arrest only. And I left out this sudden cardiac arrest group. Yeah. And I'm now very much aware of that. The acute treatment for sudden cardiac arrest, like you said, is high quality CPR. I've also been guilty of preaching 15 to 2, getting those ventilations in. That's probably not the right thing to do for sudden cardiac arrest. So I'm starting to go back on my own word, right? Because I've just recently seen some really compelling evidence for continuous compressions.
Yep. The evidence is early and it's not completely borne out. But as you pointed out, there is some evidence. And I would say for medically trained people, we are in general more willing to provide mouth to mouth.
Okay.
And the biggest reason to do hands only CPR or compressions only CPR, just do continuous uninterrupted chest compressions, especially in somebody that went to ground playing sports, because it's unlikely to be a respiratory arrest, as you've already pointed out. But if people are worried about giving mouth to mouth, and that fear or worry keeps them providing high quality chest compressions, then the patient that went to ground will be better off if they just get compressions.
Right, right.
And I think that's the take home point is if you feel comfortable doing mouth to mouth, you've already gotten over that hesitation in your own subconscious. So God forbid if somebody goes to ground in front of you, you're going to provide high quality CPR by yourself. You're going to do 30 compressions and then 2 breaths and then 30 compressions and 2 breaths. Or if you're going to do 2 provider CPR, that's fine. But if you are and again, bystander is not a good word because we don't want you standing around. We want layperson CPR.
Right.
But if you have any qualms about your ability to do mouth to mouth, then don't worry about it. Just do compressions only.
Gotcha. Let's switch gears a little bit and go real fast. Let's talk about SVT. I think that's pretty common, right? I don't know the numbers, but I know that a lot of my EMS provider, and I know I took care of a lot of them myself on the streets. Like, there's a lot of folks have SVT. What about in the pediatric population? What, they have them early as an infant? That was a question that I'm asking, and I know the answer to that, but we see infants with SVT.
Absolutely. We see premature babies that are out before they were supposed to be go into SVT.
Why do they do that?
So in babies, it's actually most common that they have an accessory pathway like WPW or Wolff-Parkinson-White. Okay. They may not have WPW. They may have an accessory pathway that only conducts electricity in a backwards direction. And the reason I bring that up is because you're not going to be able to see that on an EKG when they're in a normal rhythm.
Okay.
You'll only be able to find that in the EP lab while they're having SVT.
Sure, sure.
Yep. But supraventricular tachycardia in babies is most commonly because they have an extra fiber that is letting electricity bypass the normal conducting fiber, the AV node that lets electricity get from the atria back down to the ventricles. In teenagers, it actually switches a little bit. Teenagers are actually more likely to have SVT from the two different pathways that are entirely within the normal conducting fiber. So the normal conducting fiber, the AV node, actually has two inlets, a slow inlet and a faster inlet. And you can actually get a reentrant circuit of electricity going around and around and around within that normal conducting fiber. That actually, because the normal conducting fiber speeds up when you get adrenaline in your system, teenagers with that type of SVT are much more likely to have it when they exercise.
Wow. Okay. And the treatment for that acutely, we're going to try to get them to vagal down, right?
Absolutely. But the important thing to remember about SVT is SVT almost always is not life-threatening. It may make you feel bad to have a heart rate of 240 or 280. You may not feel very good and you may be dizzy and you may need to lay down. But SVT typically does not make you go to ground or become unresponsive.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but is it a little more serious in the infant versus the teenager?
It is. And the reason for that has less to do with the SVT than it does with the baby not being able to talk.
Okay.
Because a teenager is not going to sit there with a heart rate of 240 for days and not tell anybody.
Gotcha.
But an infant can't talk. They're preverbal. And so they can't tell you. Their only way of communicating that their heart is not working very efficiently is to not exercise. And babies exercise by eating. So the only way they have of telling us that their heart rate is 240 and they're not doing an efficient job of pumping blood and oxygen to their body is not drinking milk. The problem with babies is that if babies can't tell you about it and they stay in SVT for hours or days, by the time you get them out of SVT, their heart may already be weak and tired and may require some time to recover. And sometimes they even need us to take over the function of their heart and lungs with heart-lung bypass like ECMO to give the heart a break.
Sure.
And give it a chance. Once we've restored normal sinus rhythm, give the heart muscle a chance to recover and bounce back.
All right. So let's dive a little bit into those malformations and things that we see. Give me three of the most common things that we see straight from utero, and then things we could pick up on. What are the three most common?
So by far and away, the most common congenital heart disease is a ventricular septal defect, or a VSD. That's a hole between the lower pumping chambers of the heart. Small holes tend to go away on their own. As you grow up, they cause a heart murmur. You can hear blood spray across the hole. But small holes cause a little bit of extra blood to go to your lungs, but they don't usually cause any symptoms. Great big holes can cause real problems.
Okay.
If the path of least resistance of blood flowing out of the left side of your heart, instead of getting pumped out to your body, if the path of least resistance is to go across a big hole over to the right side of your heart and out to your lungs, then your lungs are constantly flooded with too much pulmonary blood flow. That makes it very hard to eat.
Sure.
Because you have to hold your breath as a baby to eat. And you're also burning more calories. So those babies tend not to grow very well because they're burning more calories just breathing. And they're having a hard time holding their breath long enough to get in calories by eating.
Do they ever start out small and get bigger?
They usually don't.
Okay.
Big ones actually may get smaller as you grow up and the heart muscle grows. But they usually don't get bigger as you grow up.
How do we fix these?
So small ones don't need to be fixed and big ones need heart surgery.
Okay. Is this going to be something that we do in the cath lab or is it going to be something we do in the OR?
So almost always in this country, the treatment for a VSD is in the OR. You have to stop the heart, put them on a heart-lung bypass machine, and sew a patch in the hole to seal it up.
Okay. I saw a closure once in the cath lab, but I'm not sure what I was really looking at because I'm just that guy. I was just observing.
So there are some special types of muscular ventricular septal defects that are completely surrounded by muscle.
Okay.
That are big enough that they need something done. but are small enough that we could actually put a plug that will sandwich that hole closed.
That's right.
More commonly in the cath lab, we will close atrial septal defects, or holes between the atria, the upper chambers of the heart. Gotcha. Those were actually, it's much safer for us to close with a transcatheter device that we can insert through a catheter, a long skinny straw, up through the vein in the leg.
Right. Cool.
Yep.
What's number two most common?
So number two is an atrial septal defect,
okay,
a hole between the upper chambers of the heart. Where red blood that's already picked up oxygen in the lungs flows, instead of flowing from the left atrium, the left upper chamber, into the left ventricle to get pumped out to the heart, it goes across that hole over to the right side of the heart. And then the right side of the heart has to do the extra work of pumping all of the normal blue blood, plus any of the red blood that came across that hole gets pumped back across to the lungs. So over time, the right side of the heart has to stretch out in order to accommodate the extra volume of blood it has to pump. Most of the time, those get better on their own, but if they stay moderate to large in size, then we may need to close that either with a transcatheter plug up through your leg in the cath lab or with open heart surgery. If there's not enough tissue around the edge of the hole for the plug to catch on to.
Sure. Gotcha. Yeah, that could be. I could see where that could get problematic over time, for sure. And number three?
Number three is probably tetralogy of Fallot. Now we're starting to get into the cyanotic heart diseases or the blue baby heart diseases.
Sure.
And tetralogy of Fallot is a heart problem where the two parts that make up the ventricular septum didn't line up. And so what happens is you have a VSD, but you also have narrowing of the right ventricular outflow tract, the path that blue blood takes to get pumped from the right side of the heart out to the lungs. And because of that, some of the blue blood then will take the path of least resistance. Instead of passing through the lungs, will go directly out to the body without picking up oxygen. And so that may make you desaturated or have lower than normal oxygen levels. And that requires heart surgery.
So that was actually one of the questions from my from the questions from the field. So I'm going to get to those in just a minute. But the question was actually, we know it's rare. How soon is the surgical procedure needed to repair it? And then talk a little bit about that procedure, I guess.
To repair tetralogy or yes. any heart problem?
No, tetralogy.
Tetralogy of Fallot. So normally we like to wait until you're 4 to 6 months old. But some kids won't wait that long.
Okay.
And so it depends more on the kid than the surgeon.
Okay.
If you are having TET spells or hypercyanotic episodes where your oxygen levels are dropping dangerously low and requiring somebody to do something about it, stick an IV in and give you fluid, give you medicine to try to slow your heartbeat down, and counteract the lactic acid that's building up because your oxygen levels are lower than normal, to slow down the adrenaline that has built up. So if you're requiring interventions, extra oxygen, because of low oxygen levels, then that would be a reason to go ahead and fix it sooner rather than waiting them to turn 6 months old. The way that surgical repair is done, if the baby is too small to safely repair their heart, then we can do a Blaylock-Taussig-Thomas or a BTT shunt. We can sew in a tube of Gore-Tex to pump extra blood to the lungs while the kid's growing up. And then ultimately what they get is a tetralogy repair, which means we sew a patch of Gore-Tex in the ventricular septal defect to close the hole between the lower pumping chambers. And then we open up the path between the right ventricle pumping blue blood out to the lungs. Sometimes we can just cut out some muscle bundles, some thickened fibers that are getting in the way of that blue blood.
Okay.
And we can leave the pulmonary valve, the valve between the right ventricle and the lungs, we can leave that alone. But if the pulmonary valve is too small, then we may actually have to cut completely through that valve and open that up and leave them with a leaky valve that we can fix once they're full grown and a teenager. But that's the way a tetralogy repair is done, is we close the hole and we open up the path for blue blood to get out to the lungs.
So put a shunt for a while. Put a shunt.
If the baby is too small to get completely repaired, then we can put a shunt in.
Gotcha.
To temporarily get their oxygen levels up higher, give them an extra way to pump blood to their lungs while we're waiting for them to grow up big enough to safely do the complete repair.
What is the kind of background on any one of these that kind of sets babies up for this? Is there anything that we know about that sets them up?
So there are a few rare genetic problems that significantly increase your risk of having congenital heart disease. Down syndrome and DeGeorge or 22q11. Apart from that, and that's actually a pretty low percentage of the kids that are born with congenital heart disease, it's pretty random. And we haven't figured out all of the genes that tend to cause these things. What we do know is almost always it is not the parents' fault. There is nothing that the parents could have done differently to prevent their kid from being born with a congenital heart problem. It is not related to a glass of champagne or a glass of wine you drank before you even knew you were pregnant. It is not something that typically runs in families. It is not completely random, but something that we haven't learned how to predict very well.
Yeah, my heart goes out to that parent, because there's got to be those times where you're thinking to yourself, did I do something to cause this, you know? So, yeah, that's got to be a really tough situation. We have covered a little bit. We've scratched the surface of a lot of things we would love to talk about.
Absolutely.
But I really want to get to questions from the field. So I kind of alluded to this in the beginning. There's a couple of things I really want to keep kind of as a consistent thing in these podcasts. One of them is coping. And the other is I always want to reach out to providers out in the field and ask them what they would love to know while I'm sitting here in front of you. So I have a question about brief, resolved, unexplained events, BRUE, formerly known as apparent life-threatening.
As
ALTI. Yeah, the ALTIs.
Uh-huh.
We know these episodes are frightening to parents or observers in most cases. The infant appears to be fine when EMS finally gets there. When they get there, I didn't mean to throw finally in there. That was mean. The patient who presents with stable vital signs, whose assessment findings appear to be normal, what advice can you offer for EMS providers? Should we transport all of these patients to be on the safe side?
That's a great question, and I'll give you my thoughts, which are not the correct answer. How's that for
I love it.
Hedge? I think it depends a lot on the story. If the kid spit up a bunch of milk, had a bunch of milk in the back of their throat, coughed and choked and turned a little blue around their lips, was unresponsive, and the parent blew in their face, and I still have no clue what blowing in a baby's face is supposed to accomplish, but that turns out to be a very common parent response to these ALTIs or BRUEs. And the kid then coughed and started breathing and went back to normal. That's not a particularly bothersome story. I don't feel like we're missing something dangerous. But I'm not there with the family to gauge what the underlying level of angst is. If the family is going to be perfectly happy with, yeah, we called 911 as soon as we saw this, and 10 seconds later we wish we hadn't, then I think it's perfectly reasonable for you to evaluate the baby and say, this is a normal, healthy baby, and there's nothing that we're missing that's dangerous. Use your experience and your wisdom and your training to make that game time decision. But if there's any red flags in the story, or you just don't feel right about it, then say, you know, I appreciate that concern and that you would feel comfortable keeping your baby here, but there's just something that doesn't feel right about this. And I think this warrants a little bit higher level of investigation than we can do in the back of an ambulance or in the patient's home. And it may be that we evaluate them in the emergency room and they don't even need to spend the night, or they get admitted and they spend one night on a monitor and we make sure that everything's fine. But I think trust your gut.
Mm-hmm. I think that's great advice. I was putting myself in that parent's position, and it's going to be hard for me just to sign a release, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we had an incident not too long ago. My wife and I, we both grew up in the emergency department. We both have a little bit of knowledge, and we were both like, we need to go to the hospital, right? Because this is, we don't know for sure. It's just hard to know from that point of view. So good question.
And just keep in mind that the hospital has resources. Absolutely. Like that's, we are resource rich.
Absolutely.
Here. And we have specialists. We have monitors. We have tests that we can do. Sure. We can do exams and EKGs and echoes. And if there are red flags that warrant further investigation, we have the ability to do that.
I understand the question for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
So his next question from Mac is also right down the same thing we talked about with SVT. Healthy heart, kid seems to be normal. This often makes us hesitate to use electricity. No medic wants to shock a kid. He's referring to a kid who's gone into SVT, who's healthy. At what point should we go directly to synchronized cardioversion? And then should we try pharmacological agents first? And we kind of covered this, right? So
absolutely.
I think, you know, I love what you said. I think putting it in perspective of, you know, if they just went into SVT and it's a healthy teenager, I'm probably okay with not doing a whole lot for them.
Yep. And I think, remember the guideline is that you put an AED on a patient that's unresponsive.
Sure.
If the kid is awake and talking to you, then they don't need to be defibrillated.
Okay.
They may need to be sedated and cardioverted out of their SVT. But let us do that after giving them some fentanyl and some Versed so they don't remember it.
Right.
In a patient that's got enough brain oxygen delivery to be awake and conscious and talking to you, you don't need to put a defibrillator on that kid.
What are the differences between a Berlin heart and ECMO? Is using an LVAD versus Berlin heart better device? What are the survival rates for each? And this came from Courtney Hager. She's a paramedic at MIMS.
Yep. So a Berlin heart is a left ventricular assist device or an LVAD. The difference between a ventricular assist device and ECMO is that ECMO also takes over the work of your lung. ECMO is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. So ECMO is sucking blue blood out of the heart, putting oxygen into it and pumping that red blood back into the body.
Right.
A ventricular assist device, you can have an LVAD or an RVAD, a right ventricular assist device, or a BiVAD, both. An LVAD is sucking red blood that has already picked up oxygen in your own lungs. It is sucking that red blood out of the left side of the heart and pumping it back into the aorta so that it can be delivered out to the body. An RVAD is sucking blue blood out of the right side of the heart and pumping it to the lungs. And a BiVAD obviously does both. So a Berlin heart is a specific type of left ventricular assist device. The Berlin heart, the reason we use it in kids is because they make small Berlin hearts even for babies. And they don't make other ventricular assist devices downsized to fit babies. So that's why we use Berlin hearts in the smaller kids. In kids that are older, we'll often use newer iterations like a HeartMate 3
sure.
of a left ventricular assist device. If you're teenage size or nearly adult sized, we can usually use one of the newer models. Mm-hmm. And there are some differences in how long you can safely keep that in, the risk of getting a clot, which is one of the big risk factors for being on a left ventricular assist device, is if you get a clot in your artificial heart, that clot can break off and go up to your brain and cause a stroke. So that's one of the biggest reasons we don't use VADs unless you really need one.
Right.
As far as the outcomes, that's a good question, and I would have to look that up. I don't know.
Sure. That's fair.
The percentage of how many kids that we put on a Berlin ultimately survive to transplant.
That was going to be my next question, because I think that people need to understand why we're even putting them on a Berlin, or why we're even putting them on an LVAD.
Yeah. So in this case, pediatrics is very different than adults. In adults, if you have end-stage heart failure, one of your options may be implanting a ventricular assist device as destination therapy. Sure. What that means is there's some medical reason, your age, or you have other organ systems that are damaged, that we can't do a heart transplant for you. So we're going to put a ventricular assist device in you so that you can live out the rest of your days without suffering from heart failure symptoms, to try to improve your quality and quantity of life. But that is your last ditch effort, is a ventricular assist device. In pediatrics, because our expectation is a much longer lifespan, we don't use ventricular assist devices as destination therapy. We use them as a bridge to either recovery or a bridge to transplant. Probably at least 9 times out of 10, the reason that we put a Berlin in or a HeartMate 3 is as a bridge to transplant.
Gotcha.
So we're going to optimize your hemodynamics. We're going to try to let you recover because you're obviously so sick. We think you need somebody else's heart. The advantage of a ventricular assist device is it will pump blood for your heart to let your kidneys and your lungs and your brain rehabilitate or prehabilitate and recover to get you in as good a shape as possible for when we do get the call. Because the downside of a heart transplant is they don't grow on trees. We right. don't have a heart waiting for you as soon as you're listed.
Right.
We have to wait for another kid that's about your size for their brain to die and them not to need their heart.
Right.
And so there's a list, and the list may take 3 months or 12 months while you're waiting. And so the ventricular assist device gives us an opportunity to prehabilitate the rest of your body so that we do, when we do get that call and we match you to a donor heart, then the rest of your body is in optimal condition to just recover from the heart transplant itself.
What a gift.
It is. It's an amazing gift.
Like you could spend a whole podcast talking about the gift of organ donation. My goodness.
Without a doubt.
Wow. So questions about ECMO, and I probably will sit down at one point and have an ECMO podcast, but, there was a question, from Brandon Hooper about the current state of science for pediatric ECMO. And I'm just going to throw some things in there. Has that changed with the pandemic? Because I know a lot of stuff has happened with ECMO on the adult side. Yeah. Then he asked about local availability of pediatric ECMO, and I think we have that pretty well covered.
Yeah. So to be honest, I'm not sure if any surgeons outside of Arkansas Children's or Arkansas Children's Northwest have the technical skills or ability or support to put somebody on VA, to put a kid on VA ECMO.
Right.
But we absolutely do here, and we do it fairly frequently. I would say probably on average, we have 3 to 5 patients a month go on ECMO, including in the cardiac intensive care unit, the pediatric ICU, and the neonatal ICU. And our outcomes depend largely on why you went on ECMO in the first place.
Sure.
If you went on ECMO because you were a newborn baby and you aspirated meconium, then your chances of coming off ECMO are very, very good. If you go on ECMO after a heart surgery, because of something that we find out is fixable, your chances of recovering from that and coming off ECMO and surviving to go home are excellent. If you go on for a respiratory problem, pneumonia with pulmonary hypertension or something like that, yeah, your chances of needing a prolonged ECMO course are much higher. And the longer you're on ECMO, the harder it is to get you off.
Sure.
But having said that, we've had patients stay on ECMO for months and then come off and go home.
Amazing.
So we've had some incredible success stories.
Right. And that's not all based on the fact. It's not just the whole onus doesn't lay on ECMO, right? It could be because they developed, you know, worse lung disease, or the prolonged intubation and ventilation is a problem as well. And there's so many other factors that play into that whole scenario. So you can't put it all in there. I got one last question where we can kind of wrap up this. Quite a few questions from the field, and I really appreciate it. I'm trying to get all of these people launched.
Absolutely.
Really appreciate it. So Brandon Hooper, he's a paramedic and educator over in MIMS, and he's asking this question about the management of symptomatic bradycardia. Seems to be an emphasis, and I agree, it does seem to be an emphasis on epinephrine for pediatrics.
Yep.
And more atropine for adults. What is that? Do you know?
I don't. So in my mind, atropine, because it's a vagolytic drug, if the reason you're bradycardic is clearly related to vagal tone, if you have a brain injury, if you've had a stroke, if you've had some reason for your vagus nerve to be overactive,
okay,
then atropine is absolutely the right thing to try.
Wow. That probably answers that, because I mean, that's not something that kids.
Well, kids have reflux. Kids have lots of things that will trigger the vagus nerve. But whether or not that's immediately evident that at the time you're trying to resuscitate somebody who symptomatically got a heart rate in the 30s, it's never wrong to pick epi.
I just want to say thank you again. Thanks for everything you do. Thanks for supporting what I do with Project Adam.
Pleasure.
And we've had some success this last year, and I'm really, really happy about that. And we're just going to keep doing it. Thank you for everything you do. Thank you for caring so much about your patients and their families. Thanks for spending time answering these questions and walking through this stuff with me and explaining some things to me. We should do it again.
Absolutely. Count on it. And thank you, Charles. I sincerely appreciate you being the boots on the ground, going out and seeing all of these schools and being a presence and giving them the resources they need to successfully resuscitate these kids. It's a game changer.
Thank you so much, each and every one of you guys, for listening, for tuning in, for picking us up on wherever you listen to your podcast. It means a lot to us. We know that you guys do not see as many kids as we do, because that's all we see is kids. And so we've learned a few things along the way. We want to support you when you're taking care of pediatric patients out there. So thank you so much to each one of you guys. Please take care of each other. Be safe out there. And we'll see you on the next episode of Providing Pediatrics.